Good morning. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Bryan, Judge Hooten, Judge Sleater, the Honorable Jeffrey M. Bryan presiding. The first case this morning is 820-1539, Vincent Holdings, LLC versus John Castle.
Good morning. May it please the court.
Just a minute. Good morning to you. I was looking for the mute button. It took me a while. First of all, let me thank you for being willing to participate remotely in these arguments. We are not in person, but the same rules apply. I also want to make a couple of comments. First off, we understand that from time to time, there may be interruptions, pets, doorbells, if you're appearing from your home, that sort of thing. We'll do our best to keep them to a minimum, and I hope that you will do the same. But they do happen, and we understand if that does happen. Second, if for any reason somebody freezes or drops off or we have some other glitch, we'll do our best to stop the clock and make sure that you have each had the full time allotted to make your arguments to the court. And last, because these are being audio recorded, I ask that you begin by saying your name and the party that you represent. This is also why you should try to mute your microphones when you're not presenting an argument. And I want to say for the participants in the room that are not presenting arguments, that we require all parties and participants refrain from making any of their own recordings. It's the official audio recording that we are making that will be available for folks after today's argument. And if there are no questions, then we can begin. Miss, is it Barron or Barron?
Barron.
All right, go ahead, Miss Barron.
May it please the court. Thank you. Good morning. My name is Geraldine Barron. I have been admitted pro hoc vitae in this reviewing court, as I was in Hennepin County, the lower court. I'm an Illinois lawyer. I represent defendant John Castle. The plaintiff in this case, Vincent Holdings, is a Minnesota holding company. It's a member of a holding company that's located in Illinois, the Castle Rock Group, LLC. Mr. Castle, the defendant in this case, is general counsel to the Castle Rock Group. He also, Mr. Castle, is a member of one of the members of the Castle Rock Group, which is Castle Worldwide. I'm giving you this background because there's a lot of different parties in the case. We believe that we are here litigating this case in Minnesota because the Castle Rock Group has a member, Vincent Holdings, that's located in Minnesota. Mr. Castle was only in Minnesota and only directed calls and emails into Minnesota in his work as general counsel because Vincent Holdings is located there. Under Walden versus Fiore, a 2014 Supreme Court case, Vincent Holdings' place of residence is not enough to require Mr. Castle to defend himself there. So what's the suit about as it relates at least to this appeal? The suit's about Vincent Holdings claiming that Mr. Castle, general counsel to the Castle Rock Group, provided it, Vincent Holdings, with deficient legal services, and also that Mr. Castle failed to tell them, Vincent Holdings, that he was not licensed to practice law in Minnesota. So Mr. Castle moved to dismiss the complaint that was brought against him. He objected.
Ms. Barron, can I interrupt you just a moment? Because I just want to make sure I understand some facts here.
Absolutely.
First of all, as I understand the parent company, am I correct? It's a parent company is the TG, and let me get the initials right. I'm sure you'll know right off the hand, but who is the parent company?
Well, the Castle Rock Group, so TGRG. TGRG is a holding company. It holds five different subsidiaries, but it is not the parent to Vincent Holdings. Vincent Holdings is a member.
It's a holding company. So they're all affiliated.
That's right.
Vincent all Holdings. Affiliated companies. And is Vincent Holdings, aren't they an owner of the holding company?
Vincent Holdings is a owner, a member.
And is the percentage, isn't it more than half?
It is 57%.
That's what I recall. And I know that your client, Mr. Castle, was an attorney. Who did Mr. Castle, I mean, was he attorney for the entire TCRG affiliated companies?
Yes.
All right.
But he was not a, he was not the, at least as we're alleging, it's different, an allegation in the complaint is different. But as we have represented in Mr. Castle's declaration, he did not represent Vincent Holdings, a member.
Well, and I know he said that, but one thing I noted in reviewing your submissions in conjunction with this appeal is that you make very little reference to the affidavit that was submitted in response to your client's affidavit by Dale Francis. And there's very little discussion of how that affidavit should be considered by the court. In fact, if I read your brief, it's almost like you indicate that once you send your affidavit in, that's the end of it.
That may be the impression that we left. I would like to say that under Hoff versus Kempton, a Minnesota Supreme Court case in 1982, which refined the holding in hard drives versus the city of La Crosse, another Minnesota Supreme Court case from 1976, the court said that the plaintiff, when being challenged with a motion to dismiss for lack of personal jurisdiction, can't rest on the general allegations in the complaint. They need, if it's challenged by an affidavit from the defendant, they need to provide specific facts in another document. And so Dale Francis provided this affidavit that you're referring to. It's document number 20 in the record.
It's a fair statement that Dale Francis's affidavit basically countered your client's affidavit. In fact, they are not entirely consistent. Isn't that a fair statement?
I would say that Dale Francis provided an affidavit in order to try to establish that Mr. Castle had contacts with the state of Minnesota. And I'd like to ask the court to look at those allegations in Dale Francis' affidavit. Because
if I could jump in, Ms. Just to make sure I'm clear, Ms. Barron, you agree that it was proper for the district court, and because we're exercising de novo review on a personal jurisdiction question, you would agree it's proper for this court to consider the allegations in the Francis affidavit, right?
Most definitely. But
okay.
Where I will say that the district court fell down in her analysis was that she did not consider at all Mr. Castle's information. Basically, what she indicated was that once there was allegations in the complaint and supporting documents in an affidavit, that was it. There was no further analysis that needed to be done. And that's where the error came in. Looking at Mr. Francis's affidavit, there are basically three different points that I'd like to identify. First, Mr. Francis, who's a member of Vincent Holdings, averts that Mr. Castle provided legal advice to it. But in making that generalized statement, it's at paragraphs 13 and 14 in the affidavit, he refers it directly back to the complaint, which means that he's resting on the generalized statements in the complaint. These were the allegations that were these were some of the allegations that were challenged by the defendant. Secondly, Mr. Francis asked the court to refer to legal advice that he claims were provided to Vincent Holdings for concerning registration and the certification of employees. That's paragraphs 16 and 17 of the affidavit. He also refers to three different legal contracts that he contends that Mr. Castle provided to Vincent Holdings, the operating agreement, an amended operating agreement, and a putative divestiture agreement. But what's critical about that is that there's no indication in the complaint or in Mr. Francis's affidavit where those alleged services were provided. And in Mr. Castle's affidavit, which was wholly ignored, by the district court, he specifically states that those activities, to the extent that they were done in Illinois. And what he actually says is that the legal advice that he gave about registration and certification was to Castle Rock Group and to its wholly owned subsidiaries, not to Vincent Holdings, which was itself a holding company. And well, that the legal...
I mean, it sounds like to me you're still arguing the dispute, because when I look at the affidavit, I mean, there's a claim that your client came to Minnesota in September of 2017, and then March, May, and September of 2018. And during those visits, there was legal advice given to Vincent Holdings. Now, so that's our dispute. And I want to get, rather than argue these facts, because we're not a fact finder here. So how is the judge to consider these facts? I mean, these alleged facts. Do you disagree with the proposition that just looking at the complaint, if we had nothing but the complaint, that the judge is to consider those facts as alleged as true for purposes of determining whether there's personal jurisdiction?
If there were nothing but the complaint, the court would consider that as true. And I also will take you one step further and say that the court should also be looking at and considering the statements in the allegation or in the affidavit and considering those to be true, but not in a vacuum. The court also needs to consider the additional information, not weigh it, but consider it. And when you look at what information was specifically provided by Mr. Francis, it's insufficient to establish the necessary minimum context for Mr. Castle in Minnesota. We're not saying that there's no claim here or that that Vincent Holdings couldn't present some type of claim on the merits. We're saying we're in the wrong court. We're in the wrong court because Mr. Castle didn't do enough, and not enough was alleged here that's tied directly to the legal malpractice claims or the fraud claims against him to hold him in Minnesota.
Well, and let me just stop you again, because I just want to get this straight on what our standard of review is or what the district court should have done here. So once he gets your client's affidavit, and then gets the next affidavit from the plaintiffs here, then at that point, what standard should the court utilize in resolving this dispute, facts?
That's right. Well, the court's deciding whether there's sufficient allegations in the documents presented before the court to decide whether it makes sense under the Constitution to require Mr. Castle to defend himself here. So the court has to look at this information.
But if the court, the court has competing affidavits, all right?
Right.
Is the standard that the court, notwithstanding the competing affidavits, has to consider the facts presented by the plaintiffs in the light most favorable to their position?
I agree with you. They do have to consider it in the light most favorable to the plaintiff, but they still have to get through all that information and do the analysis and determine whether or not the contexts are there. And we're saying that those contexts weren't there. The court just stopped. Didn't continue the analysis.
Well, argument that if we just take the Francis affidavit with the complaint together, all those facts is true, it's insufficient as a matter of law?
Yes.
Insufficient context.
Is
that your position?
It is, because you have to also look at what's been provided to challenge those allegations.
But how can you ignore that? That's where I'm losing you. How can you do that if you take those as true just by themselves without your affidavit? How can you argue that your affidavit that your client's affidavit somehow changes this dynamic.
Well, let's just look at the affidavit of Dale Francis. When you look at the affidavit of Dale Francis, he does not say where any of this registration advice, certification advice was provided. He doesn't say where the legal contracts were done. He only says that legal advice was provided to it, but that's what he said in the complaint. He doesn't say anything further, despite being challenged. And then he talks about a number of different entities, Vincent Anoka, Vincent Watford, Mr. Litvin, even himself. And he says, look at all this other legal advice that Mr. Castle provided. None of that is related to the claims made against Mr. Castle by Vincent Holdings, because Vincent Anoka, Vincent Watford, Mr. Litvin, Mr. Francis, they are not Vincent Holdings. And since they are not Vincent Holdings, it's not case specific, and there's not enough information here to establish the necessary context to hold Mr. Castle here in Minnesota to defend himself. And the court just did not consider all of the information, and because that information was not continued, and because the court looked at Vincent Holdings' basically residence as the controlling factor, we were found to have to defend here. And it's our position that in de novo review, using a proper analysis, this court, looking at all of the information before it, will see that John Castle does not belong in Minnesota. And it looks like I have 26 seconds left. I don't know.
But you also have some rebuttal time. You do have some rebuttal time, Ms. Barron. You have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
I appreciate that. And you know what? If it's all right with the court, not being rebuttal to what's being provided, because I don't know what Mr. Lindell is going to provide for Vincent Holdings, but I would like to at least address the other argument that we've presented in rebuttal. It won't be actually rebuttal. It'll still be sort of opening, but if that's all right, that's what I'd like to do.
Okay. Judge Salito, do you have questions at this point, or should we move along in your...
No, I'm okay. Ready to hear from Respondents' Counsel.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Lindell, you may proceed.
Good morning, Your Honors. Justice Lindell for the plaintiff, Vincent Holdings, LLC. Your Honors, in this case, to support its malpractice claims, the respondent specifically alleged that the appellant, an Illinois resident, provided legal service and legal advice to the respondent, who is a Minnesota resident, in Minnesota in 2017 and 2018. So the specifics of that advice is spelled out in the complaint. It's spelled out in the Dale Francis affidavit.
Before you get to what the content is, let me make sure I understand your position regarding what I call the standard of proof that the district court should have applied in this case. You have the Hoff decision, but as I understand it, that's about specificity. And if there are general allegations in the complaint regarding jurisdictional facts, and you have a denial, then Hoff says you have the plaintiff needs to be specific. In this case, it seems like what we have is specific jurisdictional facts in the complaint and in the Francis affidavit, but also specific denials in the declaration. So the question for us is, how do you reconcile irreconcilable but sufficiently specific factual statements in the declaration and in the affidavit? What's your position on the standard of proof that the district court should have applied when, on a motion to dismiss for jurisdictional grounds, you have these competing specific statements?
So, Your Honor, I completely agree that the district, I agree with the district court, and I feel the district court did it appropriately, which is the district court took all the factual allegations in our complaint and the affidavit of Dale Francis as being true. That's the Really case. That's also the Hard Drives case. The plaintiff need only make a prima facie showing of sufficient Minnesota-related activities through the complaint and supporting evidence, which is to be taken as true. So there's no weighing of the evidence. The only question is, did we in our complaint, and now that we have a supporting affidavit, in those two documents, did we allege that the defendant operated in Minnesota? Did he have sufficient contacts in Minnesota? And I think the answer.
And before you explain why you think that's correct, and I understand that it's really only the first three of those five factors that are at play. And it seems like from Ms. Barron's argument that it's really the third factor, the connection of the cause of action to the context, that's the that is being disputed here. But before we get to that, I do want to ask your opinion on, you know, we have allegations in the complaint and the Francis affidavit that is unrelated to Vincent Holdings. For example, legal advice about a boating accident. Is it your contention that legal advice of any kind to any entity in Minnesota is something we look at when determining, let's say, the first factor of the five jurisdictional factors, the quantity of contacts in the forum state? The second factor, the nature of those contacts. Do we consider legal advice of any kind, or are you limiting your consideration of those first two factors to advice that, in this case, because of the nature of the claim, advice relating to one of the parties?
Yes, Your Honor. There are some extraneous facts in the Dale Francis affidavit about advice given to persons who are not the plaintiff in this lawsuit. And I don't think that that is something that has to be considered, frankly. The question is, under the Minnesota long arm statute and under just general civil principles, did the advice given to the plaintiff by the defendant in Minnesota cause damage to the plaintiff in Minnesota? And all of those allegations are fully fleshed out. And I would point to paragraph 6 and its subparagraphs of the Francis affidavit. I would point to paragraph 15 of the Francis affidavit, where they're specifically talking about the legal advice with respect to the operating agreement that caused, that allegedly caused hundreds of thousands, or pardon me, thousands of dollars of damages to the plaintiff. So,
and then maybe you could point us to the language in the in those paragraphs, because Ms. Barron contends that there's nothing in the Francis affidavit that says that advice occurred in Minnesota.
Well, I feel that that's just overlooking the Francis affidavit, which frankly was the difficulty they had at the district court level, arguing basically solely the allegations of the complaint and saying, well, these are just general, it's not enough, and ignoring the fact that Mr. Francis had put in an affidavit. And so, and that's paragraph 6 that talks about five physical trips to the state of Minnesota. And so you've got a March 2017 trip, where defendant was here providing advice to Vincent Holdings concerning its relationship with Trinity Global Holdings, which is the TCRG entity that we're talking about.
And that paragraph makes it clear in your view that that advice occurred during the physical trip?
Yes. He specifically is talking about five physical trips to the state of Minnesota. During each of these trips, the defendant provided legal services to plaintiff. And then he goes on to list the specific trips. March 7 to 8, 2017, Mr. Francis was present when defendant provided that advice, and he's talking about defendant's trip to Minnesota. So, I mean, honestly, Your Honor, I feel like, I mean, this case presents a fact pattern that's a lot like a bar examination question. I mean, if when we were law students, we were told that an Illinois attorney had provided legal advice to a Minnesota client regarding Minnesota business for more than a year through weekly email and telephone contacts, and also in five in-person trips to Minnesota, and we were further told that that specific legal advice that was provided on those trips to Minnesota and in those emails had resulted to damages to the client in Minnesota, if we were asked, does this fact pattern support the exercise of personal jurisdiction over the defendant in Minnesota? I think we all would say yes. And that's for at least two reasons. The Minnesota long arm statute is very clear, and it really discusses specific personal jurisdiction. So jurisdiction that arises out of specific acts. And it said that's 543.19. And it talks about cause of action arising from any acts enumerated in this subdivision. So if your cause of action arises from the act, you've got personal jurisdiction. The first act is transacts any business within the state. Well, that's paragraph 6 of the Francis affidavit. The defendant came here to Minnesota and gave legal advice. That's transacting his business as an attorney to client. The second part of the statute, commits any act in Minnesota causing injury. That's the exact testimony that's given by Mr. Francis in his affidavit. The defendant came here, gave flawed legal advice that resulted in damages to the plaintiff, Vincent Holdings.
Mr. Lindell, before you continue on, you hit on a couple of points that I wanted to ask you about in relation to the affidavit. Now, you've identified paragraphs in particular, paragraph six repeatedly. And I think the judge referred to paragraph six as well in her order. My question is, it sounds like what Ms. Barron's point is that the affidavit adds nothing to the allegations in the complaint, and hence, whereas her client's affidavit refutes the specific allegations in the complaint. So hence, you're really at an affidavit that says nothing more than the complaint. And I assume you'd agree simply filing an affidavit is not what the court considers, but is there additional information? The Riley court, the decision seemed to say that. So in effect, if I'm paraphrasing Ms. Barron's argument, it's a rephrasing of the complaint, which is just the complaint. Therefore, there's no contrasting affidavit. Can you identify, or have you already, and maybe you can just repeat it, some of the specific provisions you believe in the affidavit that has expands from the complaint's general allegations and also refutes Mr. Castle's statements?
Well, yes, Your Honor, and I'd like to answer that question in two parts. The first is that the Hoff case is clearly saying if you have general conclusory allegations as to personal jurisdiction in your complaint, those can be overcome by an affidavit from the defendant. So if your complaint just alleges, personal jurisdiction is appropriate because the acts giving rise to this complaint occurred in Hennepin County. Well, you bring in a declaration that says, I've never been to Hennepin County. I've never talked to anyone in Hennepin County. That affidavit in opposition to the complaint is going to take precedence. That's not the situation we have here. The allegations in the complaint were not general and conclusory. They were very specific and talked about things that Mr. Castle did that gave rise to this complaint. And the second point is, so I guess first, to finish the first point, I don't think there's any case that says if you have specific allegations that give rise to personal jurisdiction in your complaint, then you have to somehow make up more or provide even more detail if you've already provided that detail in your complaint. But the second point is, I think the affidavit does provide additional detail, and it makes very clear, and you got paragraph 5 and 6 in particular, that say Mr. Castle came to Minnesota and gave us advice in Minnesota that caused damages to our business in Minnesota on the following dates. So that's very specific. And the law is clear that those allegations have to be taken as true. And so I really feel that what we're faced with is just the straightforward question. If it's true, as alleged, that Mr. Castle came to Minnesota on multiple occasions and gave legal advice in Minnesota that caused damage to a Minnesota resident, is specific personal jurisdiction appropriate? And the answer is overwhelmingly yes. And we've talked about, the long arm statute.
Mr. Lindell, I'd like to, I guess this is a hypothetical. Let's assume he never came to Minnesota, but provided the same advice, either by a Zoom conference or an old fashioned phone call. Does that change the analysis?
Not at all. I think the Marquette case cited in our brief is very clear. Even a single contact with the state is sufficient. If that contact caused damage to a resident in Minnesota, and the person knew that it was a Minnesota resident, reached out to them on purpose, and that can be by email, by telephone, what have you. This isn't one of those cases where someone sent out, some type of an advertisement by a flurry of emails all over the country or was advertising online. What's alleged in the complaint and the affidavit is a very clear, deliberately reaching into Minnesota by email and telephone weekly for a year, in addition to making personal visits for the same purpose of giving legal advice to Vincent Holdings.
Thank you very much. I didn't mean to interrupt your questioning, Judge Slater. I don't know if you had follow-up. I just wanted to clarify that one point. It seemed like the argument was going there, so I jumped in. Sorry.
No, that's absolutely great, Your Honor. The other question is, does the defendant have fair warning that they could be hailed into Minnesota to answer for damages arising out of their conduct? And I think the answer to that is unequivocally yes. The Burger King case is very clear. You got to have fair warning. You can be sued in the forum state. And it's got to meet with traditional notions of fair play and substantial justice. I have a South Dakota client I've never met in person because I started working for him during COVID. I've only ever communicated with him by phone and email from Minnesota. And I've given him advice on several business matters in South Dakota for deals he's doing in South Dakota from my desk here in Minneapolis. And I think it's unquestionably true. If I gave him bad advice when I called him on the phone and said, hey, Ted, here's what I think you should do. If that caused him to lose $25,000 on a deal in South Dakota, I can't imagine that the South Dakota court wouldn't be able to exercise jurisdiction over me because I had reached into South Dakota and given legal advice. I'd transacted business there and I sent him a bill for it, sent it to South Dakota. I think the same analysis applies here. I think every lawyer knows if you reach out to clients in another state and you give them advice and they are damaged in that state, you're going to be called in there to answer for that.
Can I ask you this? One thing we haven't discussed at all, and I'm sure Ms. Barron will address this, but is the motion to dismiss for failure to plead a fraud claim with particularity, is that properly before us, that appeal from the denial of that motion?
I think it is properly before this court. It was included in their appellate brief. And I'll be very brief on this point. And
frankly, but is that ordinarily appealable?
Oh, well, you make a good point, Your Honor. I don't think you can appeal the refusal to dismiss a claim other than one for personal jurisdiction. Personal jurisdiction issues are paramount, and they have special consideration.
Should we consider that appeal if it's not an appealable issue?
Well, no, I would absolutely agree with Your Honor. If it's not an appealable issue, it should not be considered.
Can we do that even though you haven't raised the issue?
Yeah, I believe the court has the authority sua sponte to frankly do whatever it wants. But honestly, if there's a non-appealable issue that was raised to the appellate court, it doesn't have to take that up. To the extent the court decides to take that up, our arguments are set forth in our brief and we would rest on that.
Mr. Lindell, if I could follow up, I do take issue with the idea that we can do whatever we want. I think that in order for someone to get review, in order for us to exercise our appellate jurisdiction over an issue that is not final, you have to either tie it to jurisdiction or seek discretionary review through a petition. And I don't believe there was any petition for discretionary review in this case. So I guess my question is a little bit more pointed than Judge Hooten's. Not should we, but can we properly review this without a petition for discretionary review filed?
And Your Honor, I apologize. Frankly, the question aroused an inappropriate levity in me. But I believe Your Honor is correct. Rule 104, the appellate rules of civil procedure is very clear on what's in and what's out. Jurisdiction is in, a simple motion to dismiss, the denial of that is out unless a request is made and granted for that type of interlocutory or direct appeal. And so since none was made, I would agree that this court is not to take up that issue.
Thank you very much. I didn't mean to hold you past your 15 minutes, but Judge Sluter, did you have any additional questions? Judge Hooten, did you have any additional questions from
Mr.
Lindell?
No, okay. I do not. Thank you.
Then we'll proceed to rebuttal. Ms. Barron, go ahead.
You're muted.
I apologize. I should be better at this by now. I would like to address the issue about, the consideration of the allegations in a complaint and then supported by allegations in an affidavit. And I'd like to use, if it's permissible, I'd like to use Mr. Lindell's example of I was never in Hennepin County. So I did something in Minnesota and the defendant in Hennepin County and the defendant says, I was never in Hennepin County, and then the plaintiff says, oh, but you were. So basically in that situation, the court is doesn't say anything in their affidavit, because I don't think he actually said in the affidavit that they said, yes, you were.
So let me jump in, Ms. Barron, because it seemed pretty clear from Mr. Lindell's reading of paragraph 6 of the affidavit. And he was quoting from that paragraph where it says, during these visits, these physical trips, this is the advice provided. Are you saying that affidavit that says during the trips, is Mr. Lindell either misquoting that, or are you taking some other interpretation of that language that during these trips, no, these visits, doesn't actually mean during these visits?
He didn't read the whole sentence. The sentence said, during each of these trips, he, Mr. Castle, provided legal services to plaintiff with respect to the negligent legal services to defendant, as the complaint references. So he's basically going right back to the complaint and just repeating, and as Judge, I'm going to say your name, Slater says.
Let me jump in, Ms. Barron. In your own brief, you have a long, it's the quote of quotes, as I think of it, right? You have this long block quote on pages 18 to 19 of your brief, where you're quoting the district court. The district court, in turn, is quoting paragraphs from the complaint. And in each of those paragraphs, 11, 13, 16, 21, 23, 28, I would also add 29, there is an allegation of legal services provided. So if you then have an affidavit that said during the trips, the legal advice referenced in the complaint was provided, doesn't that connect enough to allow the court to assume that fact is true, that paragraphs 11, 13, 16, 21, 23, 28, I'd add 29, all occurred in Minnesota during one of those trips?
I think that's a very large stretch to make that argument, particularly if you consider what Mr. Lindell was talking about relative to weekly telephone calls and weekly emails. I mean, to suggest now that the only time that he ever provided legal services were in the four trips where he, as general counsel, was present for on behalf of the Castle Rock Group, and that seems to be a very large inference drawn from the allegations of Mr. Francis's affidavit. And I think that when this court is doing an analysis and considering whether or not Mr. Castle has to come back to Minnesota when he's only been there four times for purposes as general counsel, come back and defend himself here, I think that's asking quite a bit of him, especially when the only context that we're talking about relate to his work for the Castle Rock Group and his membership in Castle Worldwide. So to me, that when I look through what the court did in its when we look through what the court did, we would ask this court in its de novo review, using a proper analysis, to consider the allegations of the complaint, which were generalized, supported by the same allegations in the affidavit, but there was no consideration whatsoever given to what the defendant said. So is it that anyone can be subject to jurisdiction in Minnesota if somebody says so and provides an affidavit? What's the point of moving to dismiss for lack of personal jurisdiction if what you say is never considered? And so, Your Honor, what we're asking is that in your de novo review, that you do an analysis that's consistent with Hawk versus Kempler and consider everything, that especially when you consider that looking at the allegations of the complaint, there's no indication where these services were provided, and the bulk of what's being indicated there relates to services that were provided to other entities, other persons who are not the plaintiff in this case. So thank you very much for giving me the opportunity to answer questions and for your attention. It's an honor to be here to prevent this, and I appreciate being in your court, even if it's just virtual. Thank you. I ran out of time.
Thank you very much, Ms. Barron. Do either of the other two judges have further questions?
No,
I'm seeing you. Okay. Thank you very much for your arguments today and for your written submissions. We will take this matter under advisement.